Last time, we finished with a discussion of gamma and didn't quite get to a brief discussion of the zeta function. So this is useful in many of the same contexts as gamma function, as I told you about yesterday. So useful for regularization and so on. So this discussion will be brief. I just want you to be familiar with a few of the key properties and definitions of the zeta function. We'll see a little bit more later in the year. So the definition of the zeta function is given as an infinite sum of n to the minus s, where s is a complex variable. By convention, often when you're talking about the zeta function, its argument is the complex number s instead of z. It's just a historical accident. And this sum converges whenever the real part of s is greater than 1. So in we know for real numbers, this will converge as long as the exponent is minus 1 or less. And that's true for complex powers as well. So this is one definition. It's also useful to have an integral definition of the zeta function. And by playing around a little bit with the gamma function that we saw yesterday, we can turn this definition into an integral definition. So if you recall from yesterday, gamma of x is the integral from 0 to infinity, t to the x minus 1, e to the minus t, dt. And if we do the change of variables, t equals ku, where k is an integer. Positive integer. Sorry. not critically important, but it's a case we'll be interested in. Then this definition of gamma just becomes integral 0 to infinity of ku dx minus 1 e to the minus ku k du. And we can pull the factor of k to the x out front. So what we get is gamma of x is k to the x integral 0 to infinity u to the x minus 1 e to the minus ku du. Now, if we bring this 1 over k to the x to the other side and the gamma of x to the other side, we've got something that looks very much like one of the terms in the zeta function over here. So over here, we've got 1 over k to the x and 1 over gamma of x. And if we now sum this, on the left-hand side, we will have the zeta function. So we can sum this from k equals 1 to infinity. And we can actually perform the sum on the right-hand side. So on the left-hand side, we've got zeta of x. Over here, we've got 1 over gamma of x integral 0 to infinity u to the x minus 1. This is just a geometric series. And so we can sum it and get e to the minus u over 1 minus e to the minus u du. And slightly rearranging this, we get useful form. Integral form for zeta. So this, we can just write this as integral of u to the x minus 1, multiply and divide by d to the u, and we get e to the u minus 1 du. So this is our integral formula for the zeta function. So this, you'll run across integrals of this form surprisingly often. Okay, so briefly want to mention a few of the other properties of the zeta function. So first of all, it satisfies a functional equation. It's not nearly as easy to derive as or state as the functional equation for the gamma function that we saw yesterday. It's a lot, it's a more complicated expression, and it's most simply stated in terms of this other function, lambda. So lambda of s is defined to be I to the minus s over 2, gamma of s over 2, zeta of s. Riemann showed in 1859 that zeta satisfies the functional equation. It's most simply stated in terms of lambda as lambda of s is equal to lambda of 1 minus s. This is the functional equation for the zeta function. And furthermore, Riemann also showed that lambda is analytic except at 0 and 1. So let's understand why lambda is not analytic at 0. So that's easy to understand. We learned yesterday that gamma of 0 diverges. There's a pole at s equals 0 for the gamma function. So that's the reason why lambda diverges, is not analytic at 0. And at lambda equals 1, gamma function is fine. It's finite. And in fact, zeta has a simple pole at s equals 1. With residue 1. So like we did for the gamma function, we can impose that this functional equation holds on the entire complex plane and use the functional equation to define I am just about to get to that point. Very, very good question, and you anticipate what I'm about to say next. So, as was just pointed out, Gamma does have poles at the negative integers and zero. So that means that if lambda is analytic, then zeta has to have a zero at the negative even integers. If we multiply a function that has a zero with a function that has a simple pole, we get something that's analytic. So functional equation plus the analyticity properties of lambda tell us zeta of s has zeros at s equal minus 2, minus 4, and so on. So these are what are known as the trivial zeros. One other thing we can learn from the functional equation is that we can make sense, in some sense, of divergent sums. For instance, you may have heard of the famous fact that the sum of the positive integers is minus 1/12. Fact that comes from the fact that the zeta of minus 1 is equal, well, according to that definition, which doesn't converge for s equals minus 1, is the sum of the positive integers. And using the functional equation together with the value of zeta at 2, which we'll learn how to calculate later in the lecture, you can show that zeta of minus 1 is minus 1/12. There's a question. This is not well defined. This sum is not well defined. This integral is also not well defined. But like we did with gamma, we can relate the value of zeta, say for a negative value, to the value of zeta with a positive value, which we can compute using one of these two definitions. With using the functional equation. So we just demand that the functional equation, it gives us the analytic continuation of the zeta function. So it lets us, these definitions, either this one or this one, together with the functional equation, let us compute zeta for any value. So we see this. This is a consequence of the functional equation together with the fact that Riemann proved that lambda is analytic. I didn't, and I'm not going to say anything about how to prove this equation. It's beyond the scope of what I would like to talk about. Is there another question?
The same question. I was wondering when the s is the negative even integer, then zeta, instead of having zero, it's go up.
Oh, yes. So this definition only works when the real part is positive. So yeah, we have to use the functional equation for.
But this time the real part is.
Exactly. So we can't. That definition fails, we have to use the functional equation. It also has, so we found the only pole of zeta. These are the trivial zeros and the non-trivial zeros. have real part. Have real part of s equal to half, and I'll leave the proof of that as an exercise. Yeah. So this is actually a famous unproved theorem. Okay, so that's really all I wanted to say about the zeta function. Just a brief introduction to a few of its properties. We'll come back to it later, and some related functions as well. Generalized zeta functions. So we're going to move in a slightly orthogonal direction now and talk about orthogonal functions. Okay, so
why?
So the main reason is that they show up all over the place, particularly if you're solving differential equation solutions.
Two differential equations.
Particularly using
separation of variables.
Okay, so those of you who have seen a little bit about this subject may be intimidated by the wide array of seemingly unrelated equations and identities that are associated with this subject. We're not going to be memorizing all of these equations. There's innumerable references that will list all of the properties and identities for any particular set of orthogonal functions you're interested in. My goal for the remaining part of the lecture is just to familiarize you with some of the tools available, so the types of identities that you might look for, so you're aware what tools are available to you, and some properties of general classes of these functions. So this is not meant to be a replacement for any of the references, just a sort of a guide of what you can look for on references, including Mathematica has extensive library of identities and relations between various classes of orthogonal functions that you can just look up on your computer. Okay. So I claimed that one place that these often show up is when you're using separation of variables. And so just a lightning review of why that is. And just a few minutes. So let's suppose we're interested in solving Laplace's equation in spherical coordinates. So in spherical coordinates, this becomes 1 over r squared, partial squared r phi, partial r squared minus some differential operator that depends on the angles. I won't write out. It's in the notes if you need it. So this is a differential operator that depends on theta and phi. And the simplest way to solve this equation is by separation of variables. That means making an ansatz that phi of r theta and phi is equal to some function r of r times some other function y of theta and phi. So r does not depend on the angles, y does not depend on the radius. And if we plug this in to Laplace's equation, what we get is 1 over RR partial squared RR partial R squared minus 1 over R squared 1 over Y L hat squared Y equals 0. So this term doesn't depend, this term doesn't depend on the angles at all. So that means that this term shouldn't depend on the angles at all if this is going to be satisfied for all the values of theta and phi. So that means that L hat squared y has to be a constant times y. So this term is independent of y. And we can call that constant little l, l plus 1. This is what's known as a separation constant. And if we plug this into our equation, what we see is that solving a differential equation that can be solved by they can solve by separation of variables gives us an eigenvalue problem. Okay, so here we have some differential operator that depends on R that's acting on R, and it gives us back some eigenvalues times another function of R times R. So this it's very useful to think about this as an infinite dimensional generalization of the familiar problem of finding the eigenvalues of matrix. So in this analogy, the differential operator is the matrix. The R, the function, in this case R, plays the role of a vector. You can think of it like an infinite dimensional vector where its components are the value of the function at each point. And we want to solve this generalized eigenvalue problem for the eigenfunctions and eigenvalues. And the simplest problems of this type are what are known as Sturm-Liouville problems, which Dennis told you a bit about. I want to focus on a slightly different properties of the Sturm-Liouville problems, and I'll be quick. So that we can learn some of the properties of the orthogonal functions. So I'll just elaborate a bit on what Dennis said, and some of the notation that we'll set up and remind you of will be useful for our discussion later after we finish with Sturm-Liouville theory. So the Sturm-Liouville problem is to solve equation of the type we just saw one example of. So in some interval, slightly different notation than Dennis did. We want to solve this class of equations. So this is not a single differential equation. It's a family of differential equations indexed by lambda. So we want to solve for the eigenfunctions u lambda and eigenvalues lambda. So here, this is a differential operator. W is a positive weight. the eigenfunctions. Lambda are the eigenvalues. No. So we're assuming it has this form. So we can always pick a value of lambda and see if there's a solution. But what we're really interested in is trying to solve this whole class for all of the allowed lambdas and all of the allowed u lambdas. And the allowed solutions will, in general, depend on the boundary conditions. So we're interested in orthogonal functions. So which solutions to this family of equations are orthogonal? To see that, we can multiply this equation by u rho and integrate. And what we get is AB u rho of omega u lambda is equal to minus lambda integral from A to B u rho u lambda w dx. And if we subtract the same equation with rho exchanges lambda, what we get is integral AB u rho omega u lambda dx minus integral AB omega u rho u lambda dx equals rho minus lambda integral AB u rho u lambda w dx. Okay, so remember from Dennis's course, this side is equal to 0 if omega is self-adjoint. And so that implies that as long as rho is not equal to lambda, u rho is orthogonal to u lambda with respect to the weight w. As long as omega is self-adjoint. So this here is the inner product of u rho with u lambda with respect to the weight w. And so we see that u rho u lambda with respect to the weight w is equal to 0 if rho is not equal to lambda and omega is self-adjoint. Okay. So it's probably familiar to you from Dennis's course. But I just wanted to point out a few of the properties of these functions. Okay. All right. So, for most of the time, we're interested in second-order differential equations. And we can actually learn from the analogy with matrices, we can guess a lot of the properties of the solutions. And so, as Dennis told you, the operator omega is self-adjoint if it has the form has this form. with separated boundary conditions or homogeneous boundary conditions. Okay. And so this part is review, but what I want to tell you is that this implies a lot about the eigenfunctions themselves. So as long as we have all the conditions that Dennis told you about, the eigenfunctions are real and distinct. Eigenfunctions are real and distinct, and the eigenfunctions and eigenvalues. And we can order the, so that means we can order the eigenvalues. Secondly, U, lambda, n form an orthonormal basis. Of the function space L2 AB with weight W. So that is the function space that has this norm. So L2 AB W has norm. So these two properties are exactly what you'd expect based on the analogy with finite dimensional matrices. So if we have finite dimensional Hermitian or self-adjoint matrices, we know that the eigenvalues are real and distinct, and the eigenfunctions form an orthonormal basis of the vector space. So this is the same as finite dimensional Hermitian matrices. Okay. Furthermore, we get two additional properties of these functions. So one is that the zeros of U lambda n plus 1 are in between the zeros of U lambda n. And finally, U lambda n has exactly n distinct zeros. In the open interval from A to B. Okay. So we can learn a lot about the eigenfunctions without doing any without solving the equation at all. So if we can put the equation in this form, then we already know many properties of the solutions. Yes. N? So these are lambda 0 is the smallest eigenvalue. Lambda 1 is the second smallest eigenvalue. Lambda n is the n plus first eigenvalue. And U lambda n is the eigenfunction associated with that eigenvalue. Yes. That's right. So let's suppose let's suppose we've got a plot of u, lambda, n. Let's suppose this is a, and this is b. Here, this is x. Suppose it looks something like this. Just draw some arbitrary function. Then we know that u lambda n plus 1 will have a 0 in here, in this region. Has another 0 here. Another 0 in this region. And another 0 in this region. That's right. So that's the point. Is this works even if we think about the differential operators in infinite dimensional?
So,
because it's the same. So these two properties should be familiar to you from looking at the finite dimensional case. So many of the first three properties, at least, hold even if we relax the boundary conditions that Dennis told you about. So the first three points hold even if 1, S is 0 at x equals a or x equals b. So if S is 0, the differential operator has a singular point. That means the at x equals a or x equals b, the degree of the differential operator omega changes. So that's usually a bad thing, but it can change the characters of the character of the solutions at least.
They both can be
zero. It also can hold if A or B is infinite. And if A and or B is infinite, we don't have to impose boundary conditions at A and or B. All we need to do is impose impose that u lambda is in L2 of ABW and is finite at A or B, and root W U goes to 0 as X goes to plus or minus infinity. So just really have to impose a norm, a condition on the norm of the eigenfunctions. So how can we tell if the solutions to a differential equation are orthogonal? So let's look at an example. A or B. look at an example. Hermite equation. That's correct. Yes. Okay. So Hermite's equation is H lambda double prime minus 2x H lambda prime is equal to minus 2 lambda H lambda. And this is on the interval, the real line, interval from minus infinity to infinity. So we don't need boundary conditions. We just need to impose these conditions instead. So this is not obviously of the form that I've written up there. So it's not obviously in the Sturm-Liouville form. So what I've said is not immediately applicable. But we can put, by massaging this equation, we can put it in Sturm-Liouville form. So let's multiply this equation by g, some function g of x, and compare with the Sturm-Liouville form, which is d dx s of x d dx plus t of x, all acting on u lambda is equal to minus lambda w. Function of x, w is also a function of x. So by comparing with this, we can learn, we can see, first of all, we can see whether or not we can put it in this form. And if we're successful, we can also learn the weight. So we can learn about the orthogonality properties of these solutions. So let's compare. So first of all, the coefficient of the second derivative term in this equation is s of x, and it's g of x in this equation. So s of x is equal to g of x. And if we look over here, we also see that s of x with the lambda term, that s of x has to be equal to w of x over 2. If we look at this term here, we see so that that s prime of x, which is the coefficient of the first derivative term in the Sturm-Liouville equation, has to be equal to minus 2x g of x. But we already know that this first equation implies that s prime of x has to be equal to g prime of x. So this gives us an equation for g of x. We have that g prime of x is minus 2x g of x. And we can solve this for g of x. Normalization is not important. We just get e to the minus x squared. And that tells us that w of x is proportional to e to the minus x squared. And therefore, the solution to these equations are orthogonal with respect to the weight e to the minus x squared. So that implies hn hm e to the minus x squared dx is some normalization times delta nm. This may look familiar to you if you think about solving the Schrodinger equation for a particle with a harmonic potential. So the solution to the quantum harmonic oscillator is proportional to the Hermite's polynomials and e to the minus x squared over 2. And there's some more details of that connection in the notes that I won't go through now. Okay. So we learned a lot about the properties of the solutions to Hermite's equation without really doing much work. So just by seeing that we can put it into Sturm Liouville form, we learned a lot, and we could qualitatively sketch the solutions too. So I mentioned that these solutions are polynomials. So these are one important class of orthogonal functions that I'd like to turn to next. So we can go through a few of the additional properties that orthogonal polynomials have. And in the process, we'll end up polynomials. In the process, we'll end up finding a complete classification of all of the orthogonal polynomials as a byproduct of studying their properties. Okay, so one thing we know is that polynomials form a complete basis of L2 AB with weight W. So this should be a familiar fact. If the weight is 1, it remains true for arbitrary weight. So given we have a complete basis, we can use the Gram-Schmidt procedure to construct an orthonormal basis. So for the Gram-Schmidt procedure, we first need to pick one basis vector, or basis function in this case, P0 of x. Should be a degree 0 polynomial. The simplest choice is just to choose 1. And if we want to make an orthonormal basis, we need to normalize this. So 1 doesn't necessarily have norm 1 in this space. Then, if we want to construct a degree n plus 1 polynomial after we've already constructed an orthonormal basis of polynomials from degree 0 up to degree n, the way to do that is first find a polynomial of degree n plus 1, which we can just take to be x times pn. And if we want it to be orthogonal to all of the polynomials with degree n or less, then we need to subtract off the component of this function in all of the previous directions. So we subtract off the projection of this function along all of the pi, where I runs from 1 to n. Okay. And then if we want it to be orthonormal, we need to normalize. So there's just some normalization constant here, which is just the norm of the numerator. Okay. So this construction immediately implies a recursion relation, because this infinite sum, in fact, is only a sum over two terms. And to see why that is, notice that pi with xpn is back to w. The way w is just the integral from a to b of pi xpn w dx. And so we're free to just regroup things. And we can write this as the inner product of x pi with pn. And so by construction, pn is orthogonal to all polynomials of degree less than n. So this is 0 for I equals 0 up to n minus 2 by construction. Okay. So that means this sum collapses down to just a sum from n minus 1 to n, and we get a recursion relation that tells us that pn plus 1 is some constant times xpn plus another constant times pn plus cn pn minus 1. Or these constants will depend on the weight and the particular orthogonal polynomials you're considering. But all orthogonal polynomials have a recursion relation of this form. Okay. So turns out it's not too difficult to actually write down an explicit formula for all of the orthogonal polynomials. And we're going to do that by some inspired guesswork, but the construction we'll come up with, in fact, is unique. I'm not going to show that there's no other choices. I mean, it may seem like it at some points, but if you want to go back and check, you can in fact, see that this construction will give us all of the orthogonal polynomials. So if we want a formula for the orthogonal polynomials, what we want is some set Pn, where Pn is a degree n polynomial, such that Pn is orthogonal to all polynomials of degree less than n. So that means it's enough to have this integral vanish for m less than n. Okay. So if Pn, integral Pn, xm vanishes, we can construct, say, Pn minus 1 out of the x to the 0 up to x to the n minus 1. This condition implies that Pn is orthogonal to all of the polynomials with degree less than n. Okay, so we're going to solve this by guessing. So let's consider some small m and n to come up with a good guess. So let's first consider m equals 0 and n equals 1, and a and b will be finite until further notice. So in that case, what we want is just integral a b p n w dx equals 0. And it's really easy to guess something that will make this integral vanish. So one way we can do that is if we have Pn w proportional to y1. And y1 vanish at the boundaries. So we can say that y1 is x minus a and x minus b. Yes, thank you. Derivative of y1. Okay. Okay, so let's look at another choice of small m and n. Say m equals 1 and n equals 2. So in that case, if we choose p2w to be proportional to y2, the second derivative of y2, and y2 is the square of y1, then after integration, we can plug this in to our equation, and we get that to our equation here, at integral d squared dx squared y2 dx, can do one integration, and we get d dx y2 at a and b. This is 0, because we squared everything here. And minus integral from a to b d dx y2 dx. Zero. This is also zero. So we can just x here. So just integrate by parts. There's a missing x here. So for this case, we just integrate by parts once, and we still satisfy the condition. And so this suggests a way to generalize this. So in general, if we have W Pn proportional to the nth derivative of Yn with Yn equals x minus a to the n, x minus b to the n, we can just integrate by parts up to n minus 1 times, and the same sort of argument will work. Okay, so that's how it works if a and b are finite. What do we need to change? If one or both of them is not finite, turns out not very much. Basically, we can still have the same form, just change our definition of y a little bit. So let's suppose a is minus infinity and b is finite. The same sort of construction will work if we choose yn to be equal to x minus b to the n times some function f, where f goes to 0 faster than any polynomial. as x goes to minus infinity. So that will apply the same integration by parts technique will work. Okay. So this brings us to a useful formula for the orthogonal polynomials known as the generalized Rodriguez formula. And so in general, Pn of x will be an orthogonal polynomial if it's given equal to some normalization constant. So one last point before I get that. So it can be shown I'm not going to show it, though, that in fact, f has to be proportional to w, to the weight. So we'll use that. So given that, we can write down a general formula for the orthogonal polynomials. It's just takes this form. Where S is x minus A, x minus B, if A and B are finite, x minus A or x minus B, if A is finite, B is infinity, or B finite and A minus infinity, or 1 otherwise. So this works as long as one, we need WA S of A equals 0, or W of B S of B to be 0 if A or B is finite. So that ensures that the integration by parts trick works if A or B is finite. Need W of X, S of X to go to 0 faster than any polynomial. As X goes to plus or minus infinity, if A or B is infinite. And we never actually checked that any of these things are polynomials. So it's an important point to check. It turns out to be rather straightforward to show that if P1 is a polynomial, all the rest are polynomials. So we do need to check, though, that P1 is a polynomial. So we check these three conditions. This will give us a formula. It gives us an explicit formula for all of the orthogonal polynomials. And it turns out there's not very many cases to check. So given that we've gone through all this work, we can rather easily find all of the orthogonal polynomials by finding the allowed weights. Yes.
Like you say, we can show that f has to be proportional to W, but I understand it as like you can take W as a 1 for f.
You can actually show that the only possible choice is that f is proportional to W. There's no other options. You can try to go through this construction with some other choice of f, and you'll find that there are no solutions that are orthogonal polynomials. So it turns out there's only three cases to check. So the first case is that a is minus infinity, b is infinity. Second case is that a is 0, b is infinity. The third case is that a is minus 1, b is 1. And what if you're interested in some other interval? Well, you can always take one of these three cases, rescale, and shift, and you'll have orthogonal polynomials any other interval. So these plus rescaling and shifting. You can also change the normalization as well. So. By rescaling and shifting, I just mean something like Pn of Cx plus d. Okay. So if we find the allowed weights in these three cases, we can find all of the orthogonal polynomials. Okay. And so let's see how this works in the first case. So case one, if we're interested in the whole real line, we don't need to shift or rescale to bring the interval into the one of our three cases. So we can use our freedom to shift and rescale just to set P1 to be any degree one polynomial we like. And a convenient choice is P1 is plus or minus 2x times C1. Where C1 is just the normalization constant. Just want that to cancel out. So by shifting and scaling. And comparing with the Rodriguez formula for P1, we see that C1 over W dW dx to be plus or minus 2x C1. Cancels out. This is an easy differential equation to solve. And we find that w of x has to be proportional to e to the plus or minus x squared. Now, we also need w to go to 0 faster than any polynomial as x goes to plus or minus infinity. So we're forced to choose the minus sign. And we see that there's a unique weight that gives us orthogonal polynomials on the real line. And in fact, these are just the Hermite polynomials we found before. And it's conventional to choose Cn to be minus 1 to the n in that case. But these are the only orthogonal polynomials on the real line, and they're only orthogonal with respect to this weight. So any other weight, there are no orthogonal polynomials on the real line. So if there were a constant term, we could just shift and rescale. We could consider Pn of Cx plus D for for some choice of C and D to get rid of it. Okay. And case 2 and 3, you'll look at in tutorial. And complete the classification of orthogonal polynomials. Okay. So I've got a few minutes left. Any other questions on this? Yes. Two, just so that I didn't have any constant in here. It doesn't really matter. So this is unique up to shifting and rescaling. So if we shift and rescaling, we'd have a constant. If we rescaled, we'd have a constant in the weight. So we could have another weight that's exponential of minus some positive constant times cx squared. That would also work. It's only for convenience. Okay. Last few minutes, I just want to go over one useful result that will let us calculate zeta of 2. So orthogonal functions are also useful in approximating other functions. This is useful in numerical analysis and also analytic. If you have some complicated function, you can approximate it with a set of orthogonal functions, such as you're all familiar with doing this with, say, Fourier series. And a result that's probably familiar to you in some cases is that the best approximation using the first n terms is f is approximately equal to the sum from n equals 1 to n of an un, where an is the inner product of un with f, and un are orthonormal functions. So you use this all the time if you're, computing a finite approximation to, or just using a finite number of terms to compute the Fourier series for a function. So what I mean, this is the best approximation. This minimizes the square, the norm, the distance with respect to the norm between the function f and the partial sum. And the minimum value is just the norm of f squared minus the sum from n equals 1 to n a n squared. Okay. And so this brings us to the final thing I want to say today, which is Parseval's theorem. So if a function space is complete, then the infinite sum f equals the sum from 1 to infinity of an un converges for every f. Or, equivalently, f less, if the norm of f is finite, then this delta n goes to 0 as n goes to infinity. Or the most useful way to state it is that under the same condition, so if delta n goes to 0, that means that the norm of f squared is the sum from n equals 1 to infinity a n squared. Okay. And so this is a useful identity that we can, for instance, use to compute values of the zeta function, as you'll do in tutorial this afternoon. Any questions on that? Okay, I'll see you in tutorial then.